Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to Sparkwood and 21, No Ship Network's Twin Peaks podcast. We have finally returned.
Finally.
This is a No Ship Network podcast. I am your host, Steve.
And I am your host, Em. Okay, so we are here to discuss the secret history of Twin Peaks as written by Mark Frost. First, we want to let you know what we've been up to lately. We have, as of last year, we were covering Ash vs. Evil Dead, which overlapped with Vikings and then ended this month. Earlier this month. And we also have, as of last year, we started our member podcast, which we have listeners that subscribe to us financially on a monthly basis. And as a thank you and incentive, we actually produce more podcasts just for them that they have access to. And we cover things like The Sopranos, Exorcist, the television series The Exorcist, and some we talk about like the Rogue One movie and various other odds and end types of discussions that we have produced for them. And we've also done some commission podcasts, and we have just come off a really long, exciting and exhausting weekend at Pensacon, which we covered last year and we did again this year. We got media passes to go. We were able to prepare better this time for that, have better recording equipment. We had a photographer come with us, and we were able to spend a lot more time. And the reason why I bring it up, especially for you guys, because we went to a Ted Raimi Q&A, and those of you probably remember that he played Rusty Tomosky, the metalhead in the chess piece.
You said there'd be beer, man.
And I asked him a question about Twin Peaks. I asked him just if he had any significant memories about being on the set. And he talked mostly about how he had to pee and how he found out later they were withholding beverages from him because they had a feeling that would happen, but he still had to pee anyway. But he also let us know that he actually got either a partial script for season 3 at that time or the whole thing. We're not sure. But he was supposed to come back. Wyndham Earle was going to bring him back from the dead as a zombie college kid.
Which is crazy when you think about how season 2 actually ended. Because, you know, Rusty Tomosky, he would have come back as the zombie. So him dying didn't really matter. But just the ending that they finally gave us for Wyndham Earle, very different than somebody who was going to be able to bring back a undead chess piece.
So would Twin Peaks have been the first zombies on television if that was the case?
As far as I know, yeah. Hmm. Yeah, because zombies were not a thing, which might come as a shock to some of our younger listeners who see the ubiquitousness of the zombie trope all around them. I mean, Walking Dead being one of the most popular shows in the world right now. But no, not in the early 90s. It was just unheard of.
All right, so now we're going to go ahead and get into the discussion of the book, which we're going to talk about its physicality, about its contents, and then we'll get into feedback after that.
So first of all, this book is beautiful. If I wasn't already married, I would propose down on one knee. No, seriously, this is a very handsome book. I would go so far as to say stunning. It is. It's impressive. It was put together. You can tell it's a labor of love. You can tell that the people who did it knew what they were doing. I think they achieved exactly what they were trying to get out of it, the effect. It's like the coffee table book to end all coffee table books. I've seen some that are this nice with other things that I'm into, but if every TV show that I really like could put out something this good, it would be awesome. But it's a little bit too much to ask. I mean, this is Twin Peaks, so you know, it's a little bit of extra effort is going to be afforded because I think the people behind the scenes know how fanatic the fan base is.
Yeah, and to get a little bit more detail about the book, which I'm sure all of you are well acquainted with by now, it is, as Steve described, worth praising. And at first glimpse, it is immediately attractive. We have a partial dust cover, and that depicts Twin Peaks, a Great Northern Hotel, as well as the waterfall. And it definitely looks like an old photograph. It's even sepia tinted, and the architecture definitely looks not updated by like a century or so. And when you take the dust cover off, you'll see on the inside that we have the image of the mist-shrouded forest that we've come to associate with Twin Peaks, as well as the evil that lies within, without, the strange inevitability that has been ultimately ineffable, even after reading this book. But the book itself is a nice pine green, I would describe that. And so we have the petroglyph that's, would you call that embossed?
Yeah, I would say so.
And we have an owl in red, And it says The Secret History of Twin Peaks, and it's in the font of the television series, which is cool. Technically, it's an epistolary book, which people have used Bram Stoker's as another example of that, where you have a book of letters. It seems, I don't know if, you know, documents count as that and all that stuff, but, you know, who cares? Moving on.
I'm just listening. I'm learning as you're saying this. I didn't even know what that word meant.
It's a compilation of documents, clippings, postcards, receipts. There's all kinds of things in here that make up this narrative that we journey on as we read from front to cover, as we're learning more about the secret history of Twin Peaks and some of its characters, as well as we discover who TP is and the archivist. The narrative unfolds mostly in a linear fashion. It fills in some of the pockets of mystery that fuels the engine of Twin Peaks.
But there are some things that it does not do. And one of the things that I want to mention, and I don't know if I was just misinformed or if I heard people wrong or if I'm just making this up, but when I originally heard that there was a book coming out that Mark Frost was going to do, I was originally under the assumption that it was going to be kind of like just a bunch of vignettes about the characters that were still surviving in Twin Peaks, and even the ones that hadn't, like how they had met their demise and what had happened in the, you know, interceding 25 years.
It was originally supposed to be The Secret Lives of Twin Peaks. Something in the interim changed and went this way. I don't know if, you know, there was discussion between maybe Lynch and Frost and decided to not touch certain subjects. I'm only speculating, obviously. Yeah. So
I could see a conversation like that between those two gentlemen. I could see one of them telling the other, be like, look, don't give away all the secrets. Let's keep the mystery. But if you've watched, if you're reading this book, you're a Twin Peaks fan. So I think, and I'm a Twin Peaks fan, obviously. So my assessment of it, as far as this is concerned, there's other good things and other, you know, not so good things to say about it, but we'll get into all of that. But you don't come away from it after reading it going, okay, now I feel like I'm really primed for season three. There's things that I learned in this book that are going to help me understand what's going to happen in season three. You don't know what's going to happen in season three, obviously, but it felt like something that could have come out 15 years ago, you know, and it still would have had like the same effect, because it doesn't really get you ready for a newer reality as far as Twin Peaks is concerned.
I didn't like this book at the outset. And just recently, I've got an account on Dougputt.com. I've been on there reading some things, and it's actually been a comfort for me personally. And I don't dislike the story from this book as much, because I think more so what it is, it's kind of like chum for some of the more energetic Twin Peaks theorists and people who really love to unravel enigmas. Because the more I read about what some people have discovered about this book, it almost seems like that's what it is. Like, here's a bone. Have fun with this until the show comes on. And I'm okay with thinking about it like that. If it doesn't actually weigh in on anything with season three, I'm actually happier that it doesn't.
I enjoyed reading the book. I'm disappointed on it in some levels, and we'll get to that. And I think people can probably, you know, see that as a freight train coming a mile away, what we're going to bring up. Some of the stuff might not have been things that you've thought of, but some of it's going to be real obvious, and you're just going to be like, yeah, I had a problem with that too. But I did enjoy reading it. It was very fun. It got me in the Twin Peaks mood. I played the soundtrack over and over while I was reading it. And I just enjoyed it. It was a fun thing to do. But as far as being primed for season three, I think I'm on the same page with M. This if it doesn't have anything to do with season three, which I can totally see it not, I'm fine with that, because every piece of Twin Peaks has been different. You know, the first season was second from the first season was different from the second in a significant way, and then in an even more significant way, Fire Walk With Me was different from the series in tone and everything. And then the books that came out after that could be, you know, considered of a piece. You could kind of take Laura's Diary and Cooper's Tapes and kind of smush them together and put them in a category, even though they're not similar to each other. Mm-hmm. They kind of had a tone that they took on of their own, doing, you know, the other material, like expanded universe material of Twin Peaks. So every time we get a go around with Twin Peaks, whether it's in print or on video, it's something a little bit different. And I think season three is going to deliver on that premise. So we just have to see it as of a piece of that.
Right. And, you know, one of the first thoughts I had when I was having, you know, discomfort reading what was being revealed to me, I know how people who didn't like Fire Walk With Me felt now.
So you have a little sympathy for the Fire Walk With Me haters.
Well, yeah. And I you know, and not that I didn't already know that I'm more of a Lynch, you know, Twin Peaky person, however you want to call that. This definitely confirmed that. I also had to like kind of pull back and think about the other books. None of them have been completely consistent with the shows. There's been all these, all of them have had their problems. So it's almost in tradition in a way. Is a way to kind of look at it.
I can see that. I can see that. You know, it's something that happens. There's inconsistencies with times and dates. And I guess that would be the same thing. So there's inconsistencies with dates. There's inconsistencies with character timelines and things of that nature. So it's almost like when you're listening to a band and they play an off note and you kind of just go, you know what? They kept that in there. It's cool. You know, it's endearing to a certain extent. So we'll just go with it. But with this book, I kind of felt like the band became aware that people like those little off notes, so they threw in a bunch of them, and it sometimes distracted you from the songs themselves to kind of take the metaphor to its logical end. Well, what I liked about it is, well, first of all, let me just tell you that this book throws down the gauntlet right from the beginning. You have to get through some fairly uninteresting parts with the whole Lewis and Clark expedition at the very beginning, at least to me. And I maintain somewhat of an interest in history. So I wouldn't call myself a historian or even a history buff, but I do like to read the occasional history book. And to me, this was just kind of like, okay, we're getting all through all of this just so we can have the idea that there was a tribe, a white Indian tribe out there somewhere.
Mandians.
Yeah. And I didn't find it all of that intriguing, all that intriguing or very interesting. And that the book is front loaded with that. So you got to get through that right off the bat. And then once we actually get to Twin Peaks, I know that I'm aware that some of the criticisms of this book lie in the parts right before we get to Twin Peaks and then going forward from that. So when you, the middle part of it, I guess, where we're dealing with people who are actually in Twin Peaks is what a lot of people like, but the before and after parts tend to feel, they say this is Twin Peaks, not X-Files. So, you know, and I'm not a UFO buff and I'm not a conspiracy buff, but when those things are done with a light touch and tastefully, I can get into it. It's kind of fun every now and then to delve into the whole Illuminati and the Masons and this and that. Because I find that stuff intriguing. I don't ever go out of my way to educate myself on it or anything like that. I'm not reading books or collecting things about it. But and I don't really know all that much about it. But it is interesting when I come across it. But I'd have to say that the fact that this Major Briggs is the one who is the archivist, I like that. I liked it when we got into the realm of Twin. My favorite part, honestly, is Hawk. When Hawk keeps his journal and he talks about stuff, even though this is where some of the inconsistencies come in that we're going to talk about here in a little bit. But just reading it in my mind, in his voice, with his inflections and his tones, and getting to hear him curse and things like that was that was a treat, because I always really liked that character.
And this is where I should have said at the beginning, and I'll go ahead and just say it now. Since you're mentioning Hawk, he actually read, Michael Horse read Hawk's part on the audiobook, because I listened and also read parts of the book. So I did like a mix. I definitely recommend reading over listening, even though they did a really good job with the production of the audiobook. You have soundscapes, you have various readers like Kyle MacLachlan's reading on there, Robert Forrester, Michael Horse, and Chris Mulkey also reads on there, among many others. With that said, I actually liked the Lewis and Clark. I read that part actually in the book, and I also listened to it. But I have already an interest in that, because when I was 12 years old, Sacagawea by Anna Leigh Waldo was my favorite book, and I've read that a couple of times since then. I did point out as I was reading it that I was annoyed that there wasn't as many misspellings as there should be, because both Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, their journals were in the Sacagawea book, and it was just rife with, because there was no standard for spellings and whatnot at the time. It could be that this is another example of trickery afoot within the book, if you want to like say this is not genuine letters from Meriwether Lewis, because there should be a lot more misspellings than there actually are in his letters. That is if Anna Lee Waldo was more accurately portraying the letters written by William Clark and Meriwether Lewis, which I think she actually was. She was
probably, yeah,
pulling them from the journals. So I like that. And that part felt, because you had this mystery where it was more like in this dark, you know, I was imagining like this dark woods and something kind of unknown as a menace. That felt like Twin Peaks. When it got to the UFOs and I learned what Foo Fighters mean, I didn't realize that was what that meant. All of those, it felt like one after another, you're just getting a lot of like accounts of people citing these things over and over. And it felt redundant for me personally. And like Steve, I don't have as much of an interest in it. So I couldn't wait to get past that. I was very happy when we finally got to the characters of Twin Peaks, but then it was kind of an abrupt halt when I was like, hey, that's not Ed and Nadine's story. That's not Norma Jennings. I always imagined her working hard for her cash to buy the double R, not that it was gifted to her. I mean, I know the whole, you know, her mother should be still alive and all that stuff. You know, depending on whether this is supposed to be red flags to let us know that this is a faked dossier.
And it brings up a good point. I don't want to get too much into the whole conspiracy theory that there could possibly, or the fan theory that there could possibly be somebody who faked elements of this dossier. That's why some of the information is factually incorrect when it's compared with what happens on the show and directly contradicts it, because I just don't see who that would be, what they would choose or what they would stand to gain from it, and what we as the reader would be able to glean about that that would add to our understanding and or interest in Twin Peaks in general. It doesn't check any of the boxes with me. It's like an exercise in futility.
But as I go and look more and more, what people are bringing up seems more and more compelling, but isn't more coincidental.
Oh, remember what Cooper said about coincidence. So,
well, exactly. He said, when two separate events occur simultaneously pertaining to the same object in an inquiry, we must always pay strict attention. And I think, you know, maybe when you have a bunch of red flags, that should also, you know, come to your attention as something's wrong with this. We are cast as the investigator when you crack this book open. I mean, who else would be reading this book, right? I don't understand why TP didn't just flip all the way to the back to find out who the archivist was, though. That's just like, I would have totally done that. Unless she's like, okay, he's not going to write his own name down.
Maybe it's bad form for an investigator.
Maybe.
Maybe she wanted to try to figure it out before the stare you in the face evidence was made available. I will say this. I know that Em and I diverged on this point greatly, that she did not like the Douglas Milford stuff.
No, not really.
And
I would just say I was just disinterested. I mean, to say I didn't like it's a little extreme.
Okay, fair enough. I think that Mark Frost could actually give us a better overall book. This book is great for a lot of reasons that don't have to do with his freelance storytelling and revisionist history. But if he could just write a novel about Douglas Milford's time, like the transition period from between, you know, you start off with his story and he's kind of failed and he's riding the rails as a hobo. And then you end with him being basically somebody who oversaw three different alien visitation projects within the government, the latest being Project Blue Book. And then he mentors Major Briggs to be his replacement. So there's a really interesting story to be fleshed out and told there. I mean, that's a paperback book waiting to happen. That's one I would read for sure. I mean, all of the other stuff that's in there that has to do with the occult and when they bring Crowley into it and all that other stuff. I mean, I find a lot of that stuff to be, I'm skeptical of a lot of things, mm-hmm. even though I believe in sea monsters. So it's different. I'm a little bit different on that, but you know, I feel like that kind of stuff is just dime store crap a lot of the time. You know what I mean? I don't buy into any of that shit. So I could have skipped over that real easy, like that whole occult thing. Plus, I didn't really feel like there was a strong tie back to the Twin Peaks mythos, with the exception of brief and tenuous mentions of lodges. So we,
which is, that's the Moonchild book, right? And that was written by Aleister Crowley.
Right.
Which you have Parsons, who is the jet engineer dude, the rocket guy.
The rocket man.
The rocket scientist. He ends up blowing himself up. So it's possible that he actually opened up that hell gate that he'd been trying to and, you know, firewalk with me.
Interesting. See, I couldn't tell if that's exactly what was happening or if after Doug Milford had paid him a visit and they decided that, like, yeah, we can't let this guy near a government job and we may need to keep our eye on him. They kind of took that as a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and just took him out altogether. I could go either way on that one. So some of these tangents I guess what I'm getting at is some of these tangents were entertaining to read. It might be something that I skip over the second time that I read the book in the future, but they were interesting and fun to read the first time around. But I feel like I keep coming back to this word and I don't want to overuse it, but there's just a tenuous link to the actual Twin Peaks mythos as we know it, relating to the lodges and things of that nature.
Well, do you think it's interesting that a lot of work went into the history because Parsons really existed, mm-hmm. Crowley really existed, as we know.
Nixon and Kennedy really existed, right. Obviously.
And then you got Jackie Gleason also.
Yeah.
So, you know, the work went into that, to fleshing that out, to weave that in. Why would he not put as much work into the actual history of some of the Twin Peaks characters? So do you find that suspect?
I find that suspect, and I don't understand why. And there's one ominous thing that kind of looms in the back of my mind, and I don't even want to turn around and look at it. And what it is that it's a revisionist history angle, and what's happening is in my fear, in my anxiety fever dream about this, what's happening is when we get to season 3, it's going to be a Dallas episode from the 80s where the character wakes up and shit hasn't happened the way that it did in the show, because they want to retrace or they want to go back, rewrite, and then get to a different finishing point and then go forward from there. And I'm hoping that's not the case.
So alternate.
Like an alternate. Yeah, basically saying, okay, well, we're going to stop the train right here. Mm-hmm. And everything that happened after this point in the traditional canon of Twin Peaks mythology is now done. And we are going to go in this direction with the rest of it. And to lay the groundwork for that, we're going to give you alternate backstories to, you know, it. At some points, as much as I did enjoy it, at some points I felt like Kellyanne Conway could have wrote this book. You know what I mean? There was alternative facts coming out at you and you're just like, wait a minute. We specifically have a scene where, I guess we can just dig into it right now, but We specifically have a scene where Big Ed is talking to Cooper about how him and Nadine hooked up,
right,
and how him and Norma broke up and she hooked up with Hank.
She ran off with Hank. She did not sleep with Hank. She just ran off for a weekend.
Yeah.
He lost it. There was Nadine in front of him.
Right. And it's totally different in the book. Why? Why? We've been kicking, Em and I have been kicking this around off podcast for a couple of weeks now, and we really can't come to a consensus about
not
this.
Not a satisfactory one, anyway.
No. Because it all leads back to, you know, one thing that's been mentioned is there's a little bit of slipshod lack of due diligence going on. Mm-hmm. Like, the creator didn't go back and look at his own creation again before he wrote stories or wrote more about it. I can't buy that, because even if he was paying that little attention to detail, talking about Frost here now, at some point, somebody around him, an aide, a helper, an editor, a wife, a kid, a friend, someone on the street who likes Twin Peaks, somebody would have come up to this guy and said, can I take you aside for a second? Do you remember the episode when? And then let him, you know what I mean, kind of let him digest that. And I guess there's always the chance that that could have happened. And he said, I don't give a shit. Mm-hmm. But what is that? What's, you know, what's the meaning of that?
Well, I listened to Twin Peaks Unwrapped interview Mark Frost. So let me read this quote to you and see what you think about it. Mark Frost said, canon is never a word that I use. I mean, the universe of the town and the people and the story seem to me broad enough to encompass anything that comes along that's by one of the two primary creators. I mean, I have no trouble thinking of My Life, My Tapes and The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer as part of our ongoing development of this universe, and I thought the book should actually continue in that vein.
All right, so that lets you know that this isn't him neglecting what he's done before, and as far as not paying attention to it. This is him striking off in a different direction purposefully. But we're not gleaning anything from that interview that lets us know why he would do that, to what end, like why he feels it's okay to just, I mean, canon is not a thing for you. I mean, canon is what, it defines the relationships between characters. It creates the story arc. It literally is everything. I don't understand why you could pass it off so easily. The other big one that I had was, for me, and this was probably the biggest one for me, is when they're describing Pete Martell as this flannel-wearing, Northwestern kind of salt-of-the-earth type dude who's just true to his word, but he's just a kind of simple folk type person. He plays checkers, not chess. Man, that chapped my ass. Number one, because I'm a chess player. But that's number two, because I'm a chess player. Number one is because a lot of story time was spent on Wyndham Earl and Agent Cooper's chess game.
Well, Wyndham Earl was terrorizing Twin Peaks at this time, and that's the whole point of all of that.
You see this as another symptom of Wyndham Earl just being excised out of the whole thing altogether.
Yes.
I can go with you there. Why? Why? What's going on with that? What do you think?
Well, I mean, some people have put forth that it's Wyndham Earl that has modified this book, if possible. I know you don't really want to entertain that idea. I don't really either. Also, you know, another theory is that it's Black Lodge Cooper doing it.
I could buy into a Black Lodge Cooper easier than I could a Wyndham Earl. Number one, the Black Lodge Cooper is actually manifesting in the physical world at the end of the Twin Peaks that we got to see. Mm. So that could be done. He has access to a typewriter. The other Wyndham Earl just got royally fucked by Bob. So we don't even know the state of what his spirit is or what it could possibly even do. But let's say that somehow it found a way to make itself corporal again in the world. He's an egomaniac. This guy thinks quite highly of himself, this Wyndham Earl chap. I don't think that he would be downplaying or taking out his part and trying to redact his role in what happened in Twin Peaks. If anything, he would be trying to play it up. So I can't go along with that theory just for those reasons right there. But that's just, you know, maybe if I had more time to digest it. But I don't know. I still think I would come out with that.
You know, I wish we would have had Leland Palmer. If we're going to do secret history, why not have the Palmers? More of them at Pearl Lakes, the Robertsons that live next door. I don't know. I guess maybe that was probably... That's why I think there was maybe, no, you can't talk about that. You need to focus on something else. So we got something else. We got Doug Milford.
I agree with that. I think that it would have been orders of magnitude more interesting if we could have replaced a lot of the UFO, Nixon, Kennedy, Jackie Gleason, aliens at Mar-a-Lago stuff. If we could have just taken all of this and kind of put it aside and said, let's deal with the characters who actually exist inside of Twin Peaks and go into the crazy stuff that's been happening there for however long. Why were the Lodge spirits attracted to this place in particular?
Right.
Why is there such a heavy manifestation of them in and around? Why pick this town to be, you know, the entryway? I mean, I know there's Glastonbury Grove and there's things like that, and that gets talked about a little bit in the book, which is pretty interesting. But, you know, what specifically is going on with Twin Peaks and the surrounding areas? That seemed to me to be a little bit more interesting and more worthy of that than a couple of chapters on Aleister Crowley. Now, the owls walking around being as tall as people, that's creepy as fuck.
I mean, that just brings to mind for me, Margaret, her tattoo not being described as it was in the show.
I feel like there's a lot of Lucasing going on here, as in George Lucasing. You go back and you take your own story and you take some of the things that you've written before and you change them because it's been 25 years and you feel differently about them now. But it's pushing aside all of the feelings that fandom has been able to build up around these characters for that whole time. So if you do that, it better be good than what you had originally written. It better be better than what you had originally written. And it should make way for something better to come along. And I'm holding out, I'm giving the benefit of the doubt to say that this could be happening with season three. But honestly, if you look at the characters that have really been touched on this, I don't really, if season three doesn't have Ed or Nadine in it, I'm going to be okay with that. Even though I like Big Ed.
He's going to be in it.
Well, good. I mean,
you know, and another thing that I haven't really seen much people touch on is Hank's letter to Norma before he died in jail. His apology letter, which, you know, with the Hank we know from the show, I would never have imagined him remorseful in any way. But I was wondering if this was like putting forth, like, is this like a logical conclusion if you were to imagine that Laura had not put the ring on and she became possessed by Bob, then this would have been her life in some way. She would have been led to criminal acts, but, you know, still in the end.
Remorseful.
Remorseful in some way.
We could speculate as to how Laura would have handled it if she had decided to take the easy road out, you know, but Laura's a stronger character than Hank all day long.
Yeah.
And she decided, she was like, no, we're done with it. And she ended it. And then Hank never had the power to do that. He got killed by some people in jail, and he was remorseful towards the end of it because he knew that his end was coming. I think he's kind of one of those people who they're not sorry that they did something. They're sorry that they got caught. That's how it kind of feels to me.
Well, it's at the end of his life. I always wondered why he was so interested in what Maddie and Donna were talking about at the diner when it had to do with Laura. And I know he gave Laura the creeps in her the diary, you know, where she wasn't, you know, creeped out by Jacques Renault or Leo or...
Yeah, that is interesting. Like, all of these other people don't creep her out. Like, she can hang out with Leo and Jacques and be okay with it and get naked and have sex, but Hank freaks you out? Like, what kind of vibe were you getting off of this dude?
And, you know, after reading this book, I was just like, well, maybe, you know, Hank was under a certain, you know, influence as well. And maybe she saw that as her possible future. And that's why it gave her the creeps. You know, seeing that he was remorseful in the end added some, you know, credence to what I've been wondering about in that regard. But
well, I think it's his, you know, we all meet the devil halfway, right?
Yeah.
So there you go. You know, Hank was, I always pictured Hank in the most charitable way that I could ever think of him. I always pictured him as somebody who, he would have been good if he had let the better angels of his nature take over, but he didn't. He listened to the devil on the shoulder. He made a choice, and then it kind of just followed him for the rest of his life. And I think that's probably true of a lot of people who ended up in really bad situations in their lives. Or at least I like to hope that that's the case, because it lets me have a little bit of naive faith in humanity when the cynical side of me wants to say, you're all bastards, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that could very well be what was going on. He's at the end of his life examining his life as it has unfolded behind him, and happy.
How can you not feel bad about that? You didn't gain the crown. You didn't get anything. You're going to die in jail, you know? Like, what good is that to anyone? Just remorse has to be the biggest meal on your plate, or the biggest piece of food on your plate at that point. You know, that's all you're thinking about. It's like, fuck, what could I have done different? How could this have been better? But it's too late now. I'm done for.
Another character I want to talk about is Catherine. So supposedly she sold the Ghostwood Estates to Ben. And there's people who are wondering if that's even an accurate document based on the notary stamp, I believe. But the thing that made me question her story more so is when Pete and Andrew die, she holds up. And I don't know. I know she was very loyal to her brother, but I think it was to a point. And she's always was this really, I just can't imagine her becoming depressed because the men in her life are no longer there. I don't like that idea of her, because that jars with the Catherine that.
It doesn't fit. It really doesn't fit, because she's such a fireball.
Yeah.
Not always in a good way, but she's such a, like a revved up character trying to get what she wants. I think that she would be sad and depressed for a little while because the two most important men in her life just died unexpectedly in this blast. And now she would be bereft for a bit. I get that. But she would recover and she would come back stronger. That's the Catherine Martell that everybody would expect out of Twin Peaks. And I think you're just pissed because she's getting short shrift, and I feel it.
Yeah. That character deserves a better story than that. And now, you're speaking of the blast at the bank. We have pretty much figured out with the casting of Sherilyn Fenn, but, you know, she survived, and thankfully, it sounds like, to Pete protecting her with his own body. But what's interesting is that apparently Ben had a change of heart after this blast. And he's already had this change of heart. And Audrey and Ben are already on the same page. She's helping him. That's why she's there. And they have this letter from Audrey to making it seem like she was going there against his will just to, you know, get at him. And that wasn't the case at all in the show. So, which I feel like there's things being left out. So now you have to wonder if Ben wanted to maybe not associate himself with what happened at the bank because of the dealings that was going on with the Packards and the bank. So they're basically, you know, that's why she was there, to have the protest, because the bank was trying to keep a low profile at the time.
So is there any theories that you came across online while you were doing your research that says that all of the campy soap opera stuff that a lot of fans didn't like is just now erased? And Frost is repaving over that with his own version of how things ended?
No. Because, I mean, I don't think this is the campy soap opera stuff, first of all.
Well, we're knocking out a whole theory of a whole subplot about somebody being as somebody else's dad, which is straight out of a soap opera.
Okay.
And then we're taking out the Ed and...
The Ed and Nadine stuff, it was awesome. I love that story better from the show.
I did too, but I'm just saying that there's elements of Twin Peaks, especially in season two, because remember we talked about in the main body of Sparkwood and 21 Work how they took away Invitation to Love because it stopped being, we didn't need like a little side parody of a soap opera because we had an actual one on our hands a lot of the times. So it's just, it just occurred to me, there's probably not enough meat to back that up, but.
I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting idea. I don't, you know, replacing it with something that seems even less interesting, which doesn't have the urgency.
I'm not saying it's a good move. I was just kind of like putting it out there as a possible move. Because if you're like the book characterizes Ben Horn as reacting to his daughter's, you know, near-death experience. So that means that he survived the altercation at the Hayward household. So what's the fallout from that, you know? Does he have to spend time with Donna now? I mean, like, are there a lot of trips to the Double R with milkshakes so they can catch up and play father and daughter? And she has like two dads now and it's just all weird. Thanksgivings are super awkward.
Well, I don't mind that part being eliminated. I guess that's what you're talking about here mostly. I don't know.
And maybe I can be less harsh and say not the soap opera campy bits, but just the parts that they didn't feel like tying up, or that they didn't feel that they could tie up nicely or tidily from 25 years ago, and saying, okay, well, we're just going to pretend like that storyline, it wasn't out there dangling. We're going to just go ahead and go, all right, this is where we're taking it. And you get to do that when you come out and make public statements about canon, such as Frost has done. Just to let it be known, I didn't set out, and neither did M, set out to make this podcast about trashing Mark Frost or his artistic efforts. I think it's safe to say that we both prefer Lynch's version of Twin Peaks. That's why we're both huge Fire Walk With Me fans. And but at the same time, there's some real world stuff here to be tangled with. I mean, when you directly contradict what has already been laid down, I mean, no flippant comments about canon can really make that right for hardcore fans. So
yeah, and I mean, I gotta have faith in that, because Mark Frost was asked, you know, specifically about Norma's mother, and he said all will be revealed in time.
Okay, well, if there's a plan to bring this out and to make everything okay, then, you know, maybe a year from now we can revisit this book. And we can, after the series is, let's do that. Let's say that once the series has run its course and we're able to digest it and we've podcasted on it, we can revisit A Secret History of Twin Peaks and kind of look at where the book was taking us and see, okay, we should have seen this as a signpost of that. So maybe that's the best way to look at it. But until that happens, I reserve the right to have a chapped ass about the chess and checkers comment, because that's just bullshit.
Yeah, because if this was inadvertent, if he just didn't bother to go and investigate his own work,
right?
He really royally fucked up.
Yeah, there's no other way to put that.
You've got just inaccuracy as far as like when Josie Packard's autopsy should have been performed in relation to her actual death as far as the story timeline. You've got that stamp on Norma's letter. We've already discussed the story as far as how Ed and Nadine happened and Norma and Hank. Where is Fat Trout Trailer Park? You know, things like that. I mean, we could just go on. There's a lot of them. So it's hard to believe that it wasn't intentional, but then maybe it was. He doesn't really care about canon.
One thing I will say that I really did enjoy, just to bring back a little bit of positive stuff to it before we wrap it up, was the Log Lady stuff. I really dug that. Her story was pretty heart-wrenching about her husband dying in the fire and stuff like that. I kind of got choked up a little bit, for being completely honest, because I felt like it was just a really pure love story, you know?
Yeah, and the way they describe the relationship and everything, you wanted to root for them. You know, you knew it was going to be tragic, even though his end was a little different, as described.
Yep, there we go again. And then another funny story about Pensacon is all of the places in town in Pensacola, what they do is they take on a theme for that night. So one of the restaurants we were going to hit up had a Twin Peaks theme going on. So we grabbed some beers at the place next door to it, and then we mosey on over to the Twin Peaks place. And the extent of what they did is one lady had on a dress or a blouse or whatever it was that had some red skulls on it. And then she had some plastic that was kind of coming around her head.
Yeah.
Then they had Twin Peaks playing with no sound on a television, and they had the soundtrack. Yeah, the pilot. And then they had the soundtrack playing in the background. And I mean, this is one of those real kitschy little places. It's pretty cool. It has a lot of stuff on the walls, and it's a small house that's been transformed into a restaurant. And
it's a gelato place.
A gelato place. Yeah. I think they had some food items, but I never saw the kitchen. And at any rate, they had apparently the owner's best friend is the Twin Peaks fan, but she was on vacation at Disney with her family, so she couldn't make it for this. So she just kind of told everybody what to do. And there was a little old lady standing in the corner who had a log prop, and it was a plush kind
like a
of
pillow.
Like a pillow log that had a string attached to it, and she's carrying it around as the log lady. And I was like, sweet. So I walked up to her and I said, just so you know, if your log has something to say, I'm willing to listen. And she gives me this look like, what the fuck are you talking about? And she goes, I don't know anything about that. They just told me to wear this. And I'm like, God damn it. This is the most fucking cheap bullshit I've ever seen. This is crap. So we didn't stay for very long. The gelato was good, though.
Yeah. And there was another woman who had her hair put up, and she had a frame that she was wearing around her face. So there was two Lauras. She had the
That's
wrapped
right,
in plastic
yeah.
Laura, and you had the homecoming queen photograph Laura, but none of them had ever watched the show. They had gelato, which were based on the characters. I had the Log Lady salted caramel, which was awesome. And you had the Cooper.
Yeah, the damn fine cup of coffee gelato. Cooper's yeah. Agent Cooper's damn fine cup of coffee gelato.
And, you know, where we're from, this is a very right-wing
conservative area.
Lots of military.
Lots of retired people, stuff like that.
Yeah. So, you know, the fact that they even had something like that was amazing. I had hoped to actually interview people and ask them what they thought of this book, so I concluded on here.
Nothing doing.
Yeah, there was only one person that was like, I watched that show a long time ago. I was like, okay, well, let's go and head further downtown then.
Yeah, but I mean, all I really accomplished was probably making an elderly lady grab a rape whistle, you know what I mean, and get ready to. So another thing I wanted to mention about the book too was the section on the Bookhouse Boys and their particular selections of books. I thought these were pretty interesting, and I love the way that this book makes fun of James. That was spot on. The fact that his favorite book, and it's on the Bookhouse bookshelf, is Charlotte's Web.
Yeah.
And when they talk about the journaling and everything and the reading and stuff like that, and they directly reference James Hurley and go, well, he doesn't really read that much.
And there was like something mentioned to where he should read more, like that somebody was coaching him on how he should read more. I remember something like that too. That particular image, apparently, if you hold it in a mirror, reveals some things. And yeah, I haven't tried it yet, but you can find it on the Twin Peaks wiki.
And I like the fact that there is the Warren report on the JFK assassination, and that's Cooper's book, and he's got a book in the bookhouse.
Yeah, and
that's awesome.
And
yeah.
He's not totally convinced that it's Lee Harvey Oswald, right? But he's
right.
Got the...
Who killed JFK?
He's looking into it.
And Lucy is included with The Stand by Stephen King because she's the one who buys all the books. Way to go, Frost, you sexist bastard. No, just kidding.
Anything else before we move on?
Yeah, I would just like to wrap this up and reiterate a little bit. Specific criticisms aside, and let's all hope for the best. But I really did enjoy this book, although you get to the middle of this podcast and it probably sounds like I didn't. But I did. I had a good time reading it. It was a fun romp, and I'm going to be reading it again, and I want to try to like puzzle box out all of these little things. You know, I want to go on and do some research about some of the crazier stuff that people are saying, holding it up to the mirror and things like that, and do it. So I'm going to get some mileage out of this thing, and it's fun. I'm glad it exists, so I don't want to seem like I'm totally down on it.
Okay, so before we go into feedback, we want to discuss our plans for season three.
Okay, all right. This is how we're going to do season three of Twin Peaks. In the past, when we cover live shows, we generally try to have as fast of a turnaround as we can. That way, we give people enough time to get feedback in a reasonable amount of time, but then we cover it so we can stay on top of it and then get ready for it to come back around again. But I work as a kitchen manager in a high-volume restaurant and Twin Peaks is basically debuting a week before the season really, really kicks in, mm-hmm. right before Memorial Day weekend. So I might be able to podcast on another night besides Friday or another day besides Friday, but I can't guarantee it. Because if any of you out there in listener land have ever worked in a restaurant, you know that it's one of those jobs that has a super high turnover rate. So people don't show up all the time. You know, whether they want to do something else fun with their Thursday night or their Wednesday night or whatever, or they can't be bothered to get out of bed, or they can't find a ride, or they got busted for a DUI the night before, or whatever it is. They can't make it to work, and then I get stuck because that's my responsibility and that's what I get paid for. So I can't just go, hey, I got to go podcast. Fuck you guys. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So even though it airs on Sunday nights, we're not going to be podcasting on it until Friday mornings. So M will probably most likely have it up and ready for you to listen to on late Friday night, but it won't be a quicker turnaround as some of the other podcasts. But I think the benefit of it is A, consistency. I'll always be there to do it on Friday morning. And B, it'll give people plenty of time to get their feedback in.
Mm-hmm. We tried doing it where we were recording Penny Dreadful earlier in the week, and it got risky sometimes where Steve didn't think he was going to make it and all that stuff. So we've learned because we've tried to do it. So it is better this way.
It lowers the stress level for everybody involved because I know that I can always have that particular day off. Even if I worked a double every other day of the week, I would have that day off, so I'd be able to do it. So we'll just do a feedback cutoff of, say, like 5 o'clock on Thursday.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that would be 5 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on a Thursday after the Sunday airing of the Twin Peaks episode.
Yeah.
Which begins May 21st.
Which brings me to the second point that I wanted to make about feedback. With the other shows that we've done outside of Sparkwood in 21, we've had a large measure of success with structuring our feedback to get it to the point where everybody who wants to write in can write in and have a say. Because we love feedback at No Ship Network. It's one of the things that we're known for. It's one of the things that we love to do. And the listener inclusion is just an awesome part of what we do, and we never want to lose that. But we also want more people and different people to be able to feedback. So what we're asking people to do is to write a really, really solid paragraph that covers what you want to say, and so you can get heard and you can say what you want to say, and then that's it. So, and leave it to that amount. So we're not saying throw in two sentences or anything like that, but just make it a nice solid paragraph, and then that way we can cover everybody who wants to write in, and we can keep the episodes down to under 3 hours.
Yeah, like our Vikings podcast, we actually get up to 22 pieces of feedback. So it becomes necessary, and we don't want to be the ones to edit your feedback. We'd right. rather you did it for us, so we make sure we cover what you want us to talk about. Mm-hmm. We may not have a lot of people writing in feedback. Yeah. We have no idea. But just in case, we're just asking you to keep it, because we would like to open it up to make people feel like they can write in and be a part of it.
Yeah, because a lot of the feedbackers that we have are super smart. So, and I think sometimes people feel intimidated by that. They mm-hmm. shouldn't. I mean, it's all inclusive. We're going to read, if you want to do like a 2-line tweet, somebody out there, you know, and just say, hey, like this episode, Cooper was looking sharp. We're going to read it. But I mean, I don't want that to provide a barrier for other people. And but I also don't want to dissuade people who have always written in to write in. We're just trying this new format because we've had really good success with it on our other podcasts.
And you brought up Twitter, and that's another way to write in feedback if you want to participate. With our Vikings podcast, we do what we call hashtag noship, hashtag Vikings. And so for this case, it would be hashtag noship, hashtag Twin Peaks. And you could just write your comment about a particular scene, 144 characters, and I can weave it into the recap is which what we do. And that it's a great way for us to discuss what people have thought about a scene. It actually makes it more humorous. It's fun for the listeners, too, to hear their tweets on the podcast.
I think this is going to be a format that works for everybody, too, because, you know, looking back on Sparkwood in 21, there was a lot of feedback, and a lot of it was really well done, well thought out, and long. And that's because you guys had decades, literally, to digest this particular episode on whatever night we were covering, you know, season two, episode four, you know, however many times you've seen that and however many times you've thought about what you could say about it. And then finally, you have your chance. So you have like just this pent up amount of stuff. So this is going to be different. I don't think too many people are going to have more than a paragraph really to say about it anyway, because it's going to be so fresh in their mind. A good solid paragraph is about right.
So before we get into feedback, we just want to do a quick review of a podcast by Jubal Brousseau and Carl Eckler. They are doing a podcast called Counter Esperanto, and they focus on
the weird tales and the cosmic horror stuff, like the H.P. Lovecraft.
Exactly. Yeah, we listened to their most recent episode, which they looks like they're doing a run of Talking Theosophy. And in this particular one, they interviewed Nathan Carson, who's the drummer for Witch Mountain. And he's also written a book called Star Creek, which is a bizarro fiction novel. And they have an interesting discussion about that type of fiction, about music, which we were actually pleased to hear them talk about Cacophony by Rudimentary Peni, because we both love that. That's an album that you and I bonded over, actually.
Yeah, it's definitely a bonding album. And you just don't really run into that many people who have, number one, heard of Rudimentary Peni, and number two, are well-versed in the merits of the Cacophony album, because even the people who like that band tend to shun that record.
Well, even the band doesn't like
the
album.
Yeah, the band themselves, which is crazy, because it's the best thing they ever did. But
right. And they talk about some various other music that we both of us like, which was cool.
I really enjoyed the podcast because when they started, you know, they talk a bit about his writing and his background and how, you know, he kind of alternates between the band and the being an author and stuff like that. And then when they started talking about Rudimentary Peni, he said that Nathan said that he actually gave a copy to St. Joshi, which is like he's the preeminent Lovecraft scholar out there, and he said he kind of just didn't get it. It wasn't his music, which I can see. The guy's a little bit older. He's not. He's probably like, this just really does sound like a cacophony. I'm not into that or whatever.
Yeah.
But the fact that this guy knows him, and you know that they're cool enough to where he can recommend an album to him.
Yeah, that's cool.
Is really neat to me. And they, you know, they talked about some of the other writers that had influenced Lovecraft and were around in his circle and stuff like that, and the relative merits of them and everything. And it was just a nice conversation to hear, because I don't really I don't seek it out on the internet. I mean, I'll go to the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society website to kind of, you know, pick up a T-shirt every now and then, or to get their latest radio drama, which they do a really, really good job on. But other than that, I don't really talk to a whole lot of people about that kind of thing. So I don't have those kinds of conversations too much about Lovecraft. And to hear some other people doing it is kind of cool to vicariously listen to it. But I'm going to check out, they recommended during this conversation a book called The Book of the New Sun. They said it's better than Herbert's Dune. They said it's better than Tolkien. We'll see.
So, you're going to get back to us on that.
Somebody's going to have some explaining to do. And I know this has probably already been said 100 times, probably by M already, but hot water, Carl.
Yes, I've said that. They also get around to talking about Twin Peaks, of course, as well on that podcast. So check it out. You can find it on iTunes.
Yeah, it's a good podcast. I will admit to not listening to a whole lot of podcasts, but I enjoyed the hell out of this one.
All right. So now it's time for feedback.
Oh, we have feedback?
We have feedback.
All right.
First up, Joel Bacco.
What's up, Joel?
He says, Em and Steve. Hi, guys. Long time. Hope this message makes it to you before we re- before you record. I read the book back in October, so my thoughts on it might be a bit rusty. However, I was struck by the debate around it as to whether various inconsistencies were accidental or intentional on Frost's part, and if intentional, what they meant. Many theorized that there were all sorts of codes in the book, and based on some of the things Frost said and some of the clues they've traced, they might be right. However, if Frost is trying to hint at, say, an alternate universe, I didn't think this was the best way to go about it. The way alternate timelines usually work is that they start from a similar point and then branch off in a new direction. The stuff in the book went the opposite way. Nadine and Ed meet 15 years later, say, or Norma has a totally different mom, but then they still mostly end up in the same place. So what would the point be? If the idea is that someone is purposefully misleading, lying to us, I'm uneasy with that option. It would make the whole exercise seem a little redundant. Plus, the only way for the author's duplicity to pay off would be for the physical book itself to pay off somehow in the series, and I just don't see that happening. Maybe I'm wrong. For me, the most satisfying answer for most of what's going on here is the one that's probably the least satisfying to my readers, that Frost simply decided to abandon, forgot, or didn't care about various aspects of the canon. I don't mind the book being contradictory and its own thing, the same way various aspects of Tweaks already do that, albeit usually not to the extent of this book. As for the book itself, I had a lot of fun reading it. Somewhat surprisingly, I think I was more into a lot of the non or very early Twin Peaks stuff than the material in the town, although I was initially excited to get into that, especially once we reached information we already knew from the show. Maybe Frost changed some of the details just to spice things up and keep us interested. Incidentally, I'll bet Steve was relieved to learn all of his suspicions about Josie were fulfilled. He really didn't leave much room for "she wasn't all bad" interpretation, did he?
No, he didn't, and it was kind of good. We didn't touch on that, but that, yeah, I didn't want to do a "told you so" dance, so I just left it alone. But she's just horrible.
Well, you and I did talk about it off podcast, and I personally thought it was silly that they had her being all up in the fashion industry over there. It's like you could still be a criminally facile person and still have a sense of style without being involved in the fashion industry. You don't have to explain her sense of fashion that way. I just found that just unbelievable is all I'm saying. And excessive.
I mean, if they went even further with their story, I mean, she was going to be like Oren Ishii, you know what I mean? It's just like she's the head of the Yakuza or something. It's just, it was getting out there. But I feel vindicated that I didn't really play too much of the other side of Devil's Advocate with Josie's character.
And another thing with Josie, I would have liked to have seen a hint of the bad. Like, we never saw her looking under a furrowed brow at anybody. I know he also kind of explained that away by saying she never broke character after Andrew Packard's death. Like, she always looked like the grieving wife. There was, like, nobody could ever say that she didn't appear that way. But I still would have liked to have behind her curtain at least once, you know, regarding that, whether in this book or within the show.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we get nothing, and then she's shooting Cooper. And we don't even find out it's her until way later. So, you know, I think they call that shenanigans.
What's shenanigans? Okay, so he goes on to say, "My favorite thing about the book was how it adds a new dimension to the overall Twin Peaks mythos. Some have called it Frost's Fire Walk with Me, and I think that's a really good comparison, even to the extent of being done in Frost's chosen form, the novel, while Fire Walk with Me was done in Lynch's The Future Film. It's a bit amusing to me how, after all these many years of cautioning that Fire Walk with Me lacked Frost's balancing touch to bring it down to earth, fans are realizing just how wandering and outlandish Frost can be, too." Yeah. "It cracked me up in a good way how major historical figures made their way into the DP universe. I love the fact that the same universe which contains the minute observational detail of the pilot or the stark psychodrama of Fire Walk With Me also somehow has room for Jackie Gleason and Richard Nixon staring at a quasi-alien creature in an underground bunker. And that the ring introduced as the possession of a marginal young drifter in an obscure Washington trailer park belonged to the President of the United States 15 years earlier. It's delightfully absurd."
That's a good way to put it. Delightfully absurd.
"Just as Fire Walk With Me showed what was important to Lynch, the secret history shows what is important to Frost. And I think that surprised many people. It confirms something I've sensed for a while about their partnership, that actually it was often Frost who wanted to let the narrative wander into new areas and try out wildly different things, whereas Lynch, for all his surrealism, tended to remain anchored in the same premise and motif. The book also suggests to me that much of the new Twin Peaks, maybe more than half, will take place outside the town. I think there will be a clear single through line in terms of story, but geographically, we'll be all over the place. Of course, I could be totally wrong. By the way, my one pet peeve with the book's inconsistencies is when it internally contradicts itself, not just with a novel, but within a single document. Robert Jacoby is the prime example of this. As I wrote elsewhere, and it looks like you've redacted your own letter here, Joel, but I can still make out the, it's funny. But anyway, he says, we are suddenly confronted with a timeline in which 1947 is before World War II, a newspaper editor dies twice, and a 16-year-old writes a news article about his 9-year-old classmate while simultaneously attending third grade in Twin Peaks in college during a 5-year period in which he isn't in Twin Peaks.
Frost doesn't give a fuck. I'm going to get a shirt that says that.
Yeah. I guess all will be revealed to us.
Owl be revealed to us?
Owl. Yeah, that's what I said.
I like that.
Joel finishes with, okay, now I've messed up the font with that cut and paste, so it's time to go. Ha ha. It looks great. It looks like redaction that failed. Can't wait to hear everyone's thoughts on the book. Especially you two. Hopefully you'll have another episode before the premiere. But if not, see you on the other side. Yeah, Joel, we probably will do a preview podcast. We tend to do that with our other podcasts. So when we get a little bit closer, I'm trying to think about what exactly we usually like to do something a little bit different. I'm actually in the process of thinking about that. I haven't decided yet, but we will definitely have a preview podcast. So stay tuned for that.
And I definitely agree with the part where Joel was talking about how he's not really cool with the idea of this being a tampered with thing. Because he brought up a point that I didn't really think about, because the characters, by and large, end up where they're at by the end of season 2 anyway.
Yeah.
So what was the point?
Right.
You know? But see, whereas Lynch kind of, not kind of, he kind of, I keep going back to the word kind of. Okay, whereas Lynch does this thing to where it doesn't have to fit and all make sense at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. I always felt like Frost was a little bit more on the nose with stuff, to where, you know, everything's going to link up in this logical fashion. You may not always like the story as much as you like what Lynch had to offer if you're a Lynchian, but it made sense. But here he's kind of defying that, because mm-hmm. I just, what the hell would you do in season 3 that would make the Hawk's part, you know, Hawk's journal that has all of these stories that are different than what we learned in, you know, the regular.
You know, Hawk is the only one writing a journal. He's the only one doing as advised, by the way. I'm sure Daniel, who hasn't written in for this, but I'm sure he has.
We didn't get any feedback from Daniel, and I think it's because he's apoplectic at the fact that Hawk is once again playing by the rules and doing everything right, and is the only one who gave a damn. Good job, Hawk.
What do you think about what Joel was saying about it being all over the place geographically?
That's intriguing to me. I would actually like that. I would like there to be a little bit of that outside influence. And, you know, if they were only doing 6 or 8 episodes, I would want it to stay inside of Twin Peaks just for the nostalgic reasons. But since they're going to go ahead and expand it to as many episodes as they're doing, I think there's definitely some room in there to roam around a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to go back to Buenos Aires and find out a little bit more about Philip Jeffries.
Yeah, that would be go to the Philadelphia office of the FBI and mm-hmm. see what Gordon Cole's doing, you know, and possibly we can get Mr. Albert Rosenflower in there too. Rest in peace.
Rest in peace. Miguel Ferrer and Warren Frost both have passed away.
Twin Peaks actors are dropping off like pro wrestlers at this point, you know, and if anybody knows about that, you understand that's a high rate.
All right. Thank you, Joel, for writing in. And so now we're going on to our next piece of feedback. And we have somebody writing in for the first time, and his name is Mark. He says, hi, Stephen M. I'm Mark from the Scottia, I hope I'm saying that right, Scottia Twitter fan page, and have been listening to your podcast for a while now. I love the setup with your episode and all things Twin Peaks reviews, and also the excellent listener feedback from everyone who has contributed so far, and I'm happy to send in my contribution to what will probably be an excellent feedback episode tonight. 9 years ago, when the Gold Box set came out, most fans were just happy to get the full series on DVD and a continuation, as David Lynch put it, as dead as a doornail. A year later, David and Mark Frost would start planning the new series, which, like everyone else, I can't wait to premiere on Showtime in May. It's safe to say most Twin Peaks fans were not only delighted when the new series was announced in autumn 2013, but also that a tie-in book, then titled The Secret Lives of Twin Peaks, was being written by Mark Frost to accompany it. It would be the first Twin Peaks any of us would be able to take in, analyze, and study in over 25 years. Many fans were expecting a narrative tome of mythology, shorts, and novella characters to help explain and also expand on some of the mythology built up over the original two seasons and the Twin Peaks film Fire Walk With Me.
That's exactly what I expected.
While it would also catch us up on some of our beloved and not so beloved Twin Peaks characters, as far as what they have been up to over the last 25 or 26 years, and many hoped the novel would also tie up some plot lines before the new Showtime series premiered. With The Secret History of Twin Peaks novel, how wrong we all were. And really, should we have expected anything else from a Twin Peaks book or Twin Peaks product? After being in the Pacific Northwest last July for the Twin Peaks Festival, it seemed like even more of a love letter, especially with the nod to the North Bend Theater, where the movie night is hosted, standing in for the Horn's own Bijou Opera House, and also with Tacoma Airport being the real-life stage for the unfolding of the Kenneth Arnold affair. Many fans have already noted the attention to detail, or lack thereof, it seems, throughout the novel, and that it may or may not tie in to the new series, which I think, with the book being written after the scripts and new series had largely been filmed, it will.
So the book was written after the scripts were written?
Yeah, it had to be written because Mark Frost is a co-writer.
So if Mark thinks that it's going to fit in, then he's thinking that, you know, Mark Frost is basically writing it afterwards, after all the scripts are written, and going, right. Okay, so we're going to have this little bit in here and this little bit in there. It better.
With full knowledge of, yeah, what they've written for free. So yeah. Mark successfully sets up the new character of FBI agent Tamara Preston investigating the dossier, who I believe will be an active agent in the new series, and it's great to see that everyone's favorite regional chief Gordon Cole is now a deputy director, meaning the new active Blue Rose agents will have even more agents to investigate them. In the lead up to the book, I tried to stay away from spoilers as much as I could while reading the first Lewis and Clark chapter when it came available on iTunes. I then heard about the blatant discrepancy with character histories, which only piqued my interest, as Twin Peaks has never and never will be a straight line narrative, especially when you take into account the tie-in novels that came out in the 90s, The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer and Dale Cooper, My Life, My Tape, which differed slightly and also wildly with the canon that preceded the diary and also followed the Coop autobiography. Receiving the book about a week after the US release, I tore into it on a first read over a few days, but it is really a book that's designed for more than once, as the series and Fire Walk With Me are for watching over and over again and leaving yourself open to theories as you find and consider them. I think it's safe to say, not only me, but many fans picked up a lot more on the second or third or on the second reading. I read it side by side with the audiobook while checking and double or triple checking the book documents it comes recommended. Trying to decipher the novel really made you feel like Dale Cooper putting this together, which is the best and most satisfying way I can explain reading and rereading Twin Peaks novel. I love the use of epistolary novel format for the book, and by tying Twin Peaks and its mystery to many of the biggest U.S. conceits of the 20th century, it alludes to the deliberate obfuscation of any truths within. I feel the original dossier has definitely been tampered with by one or possibly more people and not all necessarily same timelines. Dougie Milford makes for a great protagonist and antagonist for the course of the novel as Twin Peaks Forrest Gump, even if the archivist appears on Dougie from time to time, depending, it seems, on what archivist is writing at the time and point of the novel. While many commentators are stating that Frost planned to expand on a lot of conceit and fringe elements he introduced Twin Peaks Season 2, if there was a continuation of the original series, the JFK killing, the Illuminati, the Masons, the Kenneth Arnold incident, Roswell, Watergate, and so on. I feel over the course of the novel, while they are included, by the end of the novel, and especially in Dougie's last conversation with Major Briggs, they are all discounted, and with the mysteries and secrets theme established at the start of the novel, we are left only with mystery. Frost is having an inside joke over the course of the novel and many of the lesser-loved mythology elements, while also including the mythology established in Fire Walk With Me, specifically with the Owl Cave Ring, which I still don't know is an agent for good or bad. In the novel's case, it seems like a deal with the devil. There are dark forces in the compilation of the dossier, and the Twin Peaks fan is in a similar position as they find themselves upon viewing episode 15 of the original that we know more than the investigating agent or seeming compilers of the dossier, in this case, Tamara Preston and Dougie and Major Briggs, with what we know of Dale Cooper's fate at the end of season 2 and Laura's fate at the end of Fire Walk With Me. The many different character histories, for me, don't point to ignorance on Mark's part. How could they, when he researched Lewis and Clark, Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce, Kenneth Arnold, and Jack Parsons so thoroughly? It points to a few explanations. That the Cooper double has received and heavily doctored the dossier, which might be confirmed if we find out who the victim at the crime scene last July was in season 3. Most Twin Peaks-based characters in the novel have progressed to what the first generation did for their professions or something similar. That's true. Anyway, the amount of doubling shown in this, to me, stands out as a coda and culminates in the fear of the double message hidden in the bookhouse boy's bookshelf beside the very interesting but unreliable Ballad of Ed and Norma by Hawk and Cooper's unofficial investigation of Josie, which should really be in the sheriff's department. The appearance of Leland with Bob in Dr. Jacoby's account also points to a Bob-controlled tome with Bob eager for fun and the aging of Laura in his account. And the suggestion that the Palmers were not early settlers is as troubling as the denial of existence of Annie, as many answers for Bob would surely have been given or suggested on if we had an account of the summers Leland enjoyed on those Pearl Lakes. The absolute denial of Annie's existence, of course, also points to this, and it might just be me, but by studying Harry's drunken note and Hank's note left before he was killed in prison, it looks to me like the same handwriting. Suggesting that Badcoop, while writing or doctoring accounts of Twin Peaks residents to make them seem to another agent not worth investigating, may also have taken over the Renault Syndicate after the events of the season 2 finale, both in the original or possibly another timeline. Which brings me on to another possible explanation, that the entirely different timeline created and alluded through many of the conflicting documents and especially the different date for the moon landing on Norma's LA postcard might have been created in Dale Cooper entering the Black Lodge at the end of Series 2. When Coop went the wrong way in the Lodge, this could possibly have altered events due to the Lodge seemingly being out of linear time and space and is somehow attempting to correct itself, as most characters with the different histories end up on the same path as they did in the original series. The dossier itself seems to have traveled through some different timelines due to the conflicting evidence throughout. The Log Lady and Major Briggs' tattoo in reverse, and also Dougie showing his mark to Major Briggs, which isn't shown on his initial Air Force medical. And also in the Major's faithful Corona, where no model exists in this universe at least, where it seems to spell Oro, Spanish for gold. The character of Robert Jacoby also suggests dark forces at work, with his time-bending appearances, alive, then dead, then alive, then dead again, and while reporting on some of the Lodge incidents and early history of the town, or it could be his father, more doubling. Plus, his picture looks exactly...
Yes, exactly.
Like Russ Tamblyn, so yeah. It is Russ Tamblyn, I'm sure. So were they twins? I don't think so. He's supposed to be older. Yeah. So go on to say, Mark goes on to say, upon rereading his passage on the Log Lady while listening to the audible version at the same time, there seems to be a lot of sarcasm in Robert's retelling of Margaret's story, as if he is mocking her, her tragedy with her husband and her life and her in general. I didn't get that.
But yeah, I didn't feel like that either. That's an interesting take on that.
Yeah. The character of Major Briggs, from what we know, where he is a wise man and a continuing agent of good in the series, seems markedly different from the show, where in the show he seems to carry a healthy amount of respect of authority in the Air Force. He appears sidelined here, and the biggest giveaway that I found was at the end of the book is where he didn't get captured by Wyndham Earle, or in the series finale, be encountered by Sarah and the Double R, which is either an alternative reality Briggs or a Bob Cooper cover-up. Glastonbury Grove is detailed a lot more than I thought it would be throughout the course of the novel, from the account of Meriwether Lewis and Chief Joseph in the opening chapters, to Dwayne, Dougie, and Andrew Packard in their scout mission accounts, to Margaret and Carl Rodd being abducted there as kids, could be a warning to Tamara Preston in the code, while also linked to the UFO lore, an attempt to discredit it. The most disturbing point of the book for me was Jack Parsons' recounting of the magician longs to see, which, along with Dr. Jacoby's aboriginal acid trip and Dougie's excellent conclusion of the extra-dimensional beings at the end of the novel, suggests to me the truth in the novel that the Dugpas are at the edge of our consciousness and nightmares in the Black Lodge, cutting through the deliberate confabulation mark, as the novelists and the forces who have doctored the original dossier would have us believe that they are mixed up in, while Parsons confirms, like above the store, there are more openings to the Lodge gateway scattered around the U.S. In summary, I love the take that Mark has done here with the secret history novel, with the unreliable narrators and unreliable memory and history, as it has definitely expanded the history or alternative history of Twin Peaks ahead of the new series. It's not the book we expected, but it's more satisfying that way, as it is not a novel but more a satisfying interactive experience for the hardened Twin Peaks fan who loves the mystery and likes to play at being a Dale Cooper. And he signs off, Mark. And you can find him at TwinXScotia, and that is S-C-O-T-I-A.
I like the whole idea that Mark brings up about the evil Cooper being the head of like the Renault gang. That's pretty cool. That's not something I've ever even considered. But now that I do, as I started having like these visions of Dale Cooper being just this evil guy that's been evil this whole time, you know? Like when the first time I ever got to the end of season two, I was probably just like everybody else. What the fuck? You know, and then you see a little bit more of it at the end of Fire Walk With Me. And then I think everybody's idea is like, geez, how soon is it going to take him to get better so he can become the old Dale Cooper again and put everything to rights? But I kind of am intrigued by the idea of him doing something like that. I mean, being the head of the Renault crime syndicate would be pretty fucking funny. That would be irony because, I mean, he basically killed the leader and took them down. So...
Well, I also like how Mark, he goes through all the inconsistencies. A lot of them we haven't even discussed about Laura's age, and mm-hmm. we didn't discuss the stamp on the postcard and various things. But he still comes to the end where he, because he's read this more than once, that it's really not about extraterrestrials, that we're back to extra-dimensional beings, which that appeals to me.
I just like the whole tone of the feedback being... kind of being on the optimistic side of it mm-hmm. and saying, okay, look, just look at it this way. We can say it's alternative history. We can call it whatever we want to, but it's Frost kind of taking us back through all of these things that happen. I want to be on board with that. It's just, I'm having a hard time reconciling because some of the things that would have to happen in season three that would make all of that okay, I'm not really all that interested in. I want the story to go in other directions. So it feels like somebody's come back and messed with a part that you thought was cemented.
Yeah.
And then you're going, okay, well now the story going forward has to come back and noodle with these parts that I don't care about as much, you know, and then go forward with them. I mean, what does it matter whether Pete Martell is a chess or checkers guy if he's dead at this point? Why couldn't you just leave him a chess guy? That's you know, that question is still in my mind, and I don't really see a way that season three is going to answer that question to a good conclusion.
Plus, was he speaking about Pete figuratively at that point?
I think he was. He was being he was using it as a metaphor for how he thinks. Mm-hmm. But you were completely wrong with it because that was one of the quirks about Pete is that he was this simple salt of the earth flannel type guy, but he would whip your ass at chess. Because he studied the greats.
Well, thank you, Mark. Thank you for writing to Sparkwood and Tony One. So up next, we have John Bernardi. We have a tome. We have a book from him that's almost as long as The Secret History of Twin Peaks.
So we came back from Pensacon. One of the days we were at Pensacon, and there was a parcel at our door.
There was.
And I was like, did you order something? No. Did you order something? No. So we came in with the company that we had, and we were like, what the hell is this? And then I see John Bernardi's name on there, and I was like, he literally sent us his feedback.
Yeah, I kept checking Gmail all day. I'm like, he said he's going to send it today. And
so John has turned in his own labor of love to rival the Twin Peaks book. This thing needs to be bound and presented to the public. It even comes with the red footnotes at the margins. So you can kind of get the little one or two or three and then go over to the margins and read them.
Which we're not going to read the entire thing on this podcast.
After we explain this, we're going to do some selections out of John's feedback because it is hefty and we have our sanity to think about. So, no, I'm kidding. But we... Go ahead.
Well, what I'm going to do is scan it in. I'm going to link up to this podcast, and then John can do whatever he wants with that link, and you guys can look at his amazing creation where he is reviewing this book.
Because a lot of it is visual anyway. There's a lot of writing in it. There's a lot of actual discussion and feedback points, of which we're about to read some. But there's a lot of it is visual stuff. And there's, you know, pages of tweets, you know, copies of tweets that people have. There's a picture of the Bic pen that he wrote this down with.
Yep. Sure, the Bic pen. There's like this really stalkery photo of the guys from Twin Peaks Unwrapped and Mark Frost.
Mm-hmm. there's a cute picture of it's an artist's rendition of Shelley and Norma having some milkshakes at the Double R. There's a weird picture of a bunch of owls.
That's
looking
a cute picture.
I guess it's,
well, it's creepy too.
It's kind of creepy cute. It's owls looking at some cats in a bed.
Yeah, I've seen that picture before.
And they're just kind of crowded around. So like I said, Em is going to upload this as a PDF file so everybody can look at it and see it in its entirety, because honestly, it has to be looked at, and it has, you know, you have to get the full picture of what's going on and kind of go through it, because he constructed it somewhat like the book. It's like a miniature version of the book.
It's a great homage to the book.
It is. It is. It's really nice. It's sweet. And I feel honored that we got sent this copy of it.
I do too.
So it's
thank you, John.
Cool. Thank you. So to dig into the selected stuff, we will start off first. The first thing I'm going to read is A Return to Sparkwood in 21. John says, "Welcome back, Em and Steve. I missed you two Eagle Scouts. Hope life and Vikings have been treating you well, and also that Secret History didn't womp you around too much. The only thing that seems consistent in other reviews is no one seems to know quite how to digest this book. Amen. What I can say is this book rewards the time you put into it, and I found it freeing. I told Diane's podcast, Rosie, back in October that as far as I'm concerned, the way this book differs so drastically from TV Twin Peaks means that Fire Walk With Me finally found its missing sock and completes a much-desired pairing."
I like the way you said that.
First note. "I also shared with her my main thesis that I thought this book was doing, and as it's remarkably unchanged, I have to thank Rosie so much for not running away with the idea for herself before I had the time to properly shape it. Back to the main body. In January, Tyler tweeted how he was having trouble analyzing the book because it's so much its own thing compared to anything else in Twin Peaks, and Bickering Peaks, which is a wonderful recap podcast that John will be guesting on in the last week in March for the Diane Keaton episode, where he will help dissect exactly how Wyndham Earle's character was steered wrong."
Huh.
Interesting. "Lindsay was also having trouble reconciling Secret History to Fire Walk With Me. That's when I finally realized what fans are experiencing right now with the Secret History is the exact same experience I went through when I first watched Fire Walk With Me in 2001. So here's a paraphrasing of my advice. Don't try to make Fire Walk With Me and Secret History meet at some mythical, ever-shifting middle point so they can be part of one thing. Don't do this. I've done this. It can only lead to aggravation. Instead, put TV Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, and Secret History near each other and triangulate. I spent years unsuccessfully trying to make a super planet out of TV Twin Peaks and movie Twin Peaks, but all along I've been using the wrong metaphor. We're not working with a super planet. We have a solar system. Secret History is its own thing. Fire Walk With Me is its own thing. TV Twin Peaks is its own thing. Their gravities influence each other, but all three are equally their own thing, and Showtime Twin Peaks will be as well. The thing that makes them all Twin Peaks is found in the feelings they have in common, I think."
Well, I like the way you're viewing it. I like the idea of triangulation. It's kind of like a way of saying picking and choosing from the various incarnations of Twin Peaks, what you will, and go with that.
It's the only fiction that I've had to have a coping mechanism to come up with to be able to understand and reconcile it all in my head, you know? Well, usually, you know, you have a movie or a TV show, and then people write a little bit of expanded universe stuff on it, and then you just kind of go from there. You know what I mean? The only thing, I wouldn't even compare it to Star Wars, because Star Wars, you just have to forget about a lot of stuff that doesn't technically exist anymore.
Right.
But you know, we're all, I feel like everybody is in a support group right now trying to reconcile all of the differences that we see that, you know, Frost has just got to be laughing his ass off, you know, got to, a drink in one hand and a cigar in another. If he smokes cigars, just going, "Ha, they think this is bad. Wait till they see the show." So John's next piece that I'm going to read is called The Inconsistencies. It's a funny way to start talking about inconsistencies, but the thing I'm happiest about with Secret History is Frost's acknowledgement of an initial codifying of Fire Walk With Me, just like when he retrofitted the European editing, the European ending of the pilot into the plot as a dream that decoded relevant clues. Even though Frost took the book into areas that specifically interested him, I'm looking at you, UFOs, Lynch's presence is all over this book. The two men wrote and designed the Showtime series together. Lynch knows which seeds he will grow into the new episodes, and Frost knows all the seeds available to Lynch. So Frost has to be savvy enough to include all the same themes within the book. And there's a whole other way you can see Lynch everywhere in this book, and I think you can say it in one Lost Highway quote. I like to remember things my own way.
Yeah.
Frost could have spent Secret History picking sides between movie continuity and TV continuity once and for all, could have taken this golden opportunity to, quote, return to form and reassert the TV continuity, but he did not do it. He veered away from all of it, still including plenty of obscure details. First one, the Access Guide's proposed high-security prison plan showing up in Audrey's letter to her father, for example. I did not catch that. To prove he's not just being lazy, change some details so we'd notice something weird was happening. 2. Any sports guy, which Frost assuredly is, would remember the Access Guide saying his team went undefeated rather than losing in the championship game, and would know this team is the Steeplejacks rather than the Lumberjacks.
Yeah, and he reportedly went to the Access Guide to prepare for this book. So he's purposely contradicting the Access Guide. So that's another reason why people are thinking that it's on purpose.
And he wrote it all with command and purpose. I'll explain my theory later on, but the way I interpret this book, I think Frost found a way to cement the presence of inconsistency so far into the fabric of Twin Peaks that he'd never need to explain any canon inconsistencies to the fandom again. Inconsistencies are now a normalized, officially sanctioned feature between Twin Peaks podcasts. I'll also come back to Annie's conspicuous absence later, but as far as inconclusions go, I absolutely adore that all of the questionable things from season 2 that could have been retroconned, the expression contortionistic jazz exotica remains. Proof positive Frost's sense of humor
that
is present.
Lana, right?
I think so. Yeah. Proof positive Frost's sense of humor is present and participating. All right. So the last piece I'm going to read out of this, and I strongly urge you guys to go when M uploads this and look at it because it's worth reading. We just have time constraints. So this is the last piece I'm going to read, but do read it all. And it's, how is Annie? He says, in your last episode, that would be listener feedback, September 4th, 2016, to be exact, I talked about Annie and Laura somehow combining into one character in the Showtime episodes while the town doesn't notice the difference due to some kind of identity shift after she won against Bob. At the time, I was just coming up with reasons for why Heather Graham wouldn't be in the cast. Now that the Secret History has come out, I am doubling down on this theory big time. Yes, hence the absence of Annie. Assuming Laura separates into two people after she is killed, as I'm implying Lewis does, I'd like to believe that Annie, Harley Payton has not quite glowingly referred to her as, quote, the saint, is the good Laura, and the bad Laura is the one with the shit life we already know well. If this bad Laura finds a way to best Bob, I can't think of a better way to satisfy a victory in one's own Black Lodge trial, thus granting access to the White Lodge. I would assume the reward for something like this is a reunification with your other half, a recombining of two base metals into a completed gold enlightened alchemical soul. And working with this logic, and what we already know from earlier Twin Peaks media, that means the good Annie sends a message to the bad Laura that will eventually allow the good Dale, the one who ends up rescuing Laura from the Black Lodge at the end of Fire Walk With Me, to be saved from the Black Lodge himself, which means Dale Cooper and Laura Palmer save each other in a wonderfully strange, time-quaked way and are inextricably linked together in a double circle of connection, a double helix of a metaphor, if I may. Where does the doctor come into all of this? This is very wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey.
Yes, it is.
And let's not forget how Dale, before his lodge trial even began, fell almost too easily for the good Annie, almost like he was linked with her, like he'd already known her, like he knew his soul's enlightenment depended on her and hers on him. I can only imagine what kind of shockwaves through time and reality this love story would send, and it would be a love story at the heart of Twin Peaks, finally asserting itself over the story of darkness and abuse that currently and uncomfortably forms the foundation of Twin Peaks. That's a good point. This, Bob's separation from Leland, Briggs' abduction, Earl and Cooper's absorption into the lodges, Cooper's possession by Bob, all these shocks in a highly concentrated space on the calendar, it's no wonder that the good Annie and bad Laura would have been shoved apart across time. And they're not the only ones.
I really want to believe this. Just because, like, we know too much about the behind-the-scenes stuff that was going on, and it felt like Annie was quickly shoved into the plot so Cooper can have somebody he had to go rescue from the Black Lodge. So this is better. I like this much better.
I like the idea. That strikes me as a really good idea, especially because it's like he eloquently put it, it kind of takes the darkness and abuse that was kind of the base story of Twin Peaks that we got and replaces it with something stronger, which would be love. And I don't mean to sound like a cheap ripoff of a Beatles song or anything like that, but that idea appeals to me.
Well, eventually it's going to blend and become something different, right? Like you've got the two elements coming together and forming what he said was gold.
Yeah, but you have to have that other side that hasn't really been accentuated all that much.
Yeah.
So that, like, the bringing in of that would bring it together, because, you know, nothing's ever so pure, but at least not in movie land, or at least not in good movie or TV land.
Thank you, John, very much for your awesome feedback, and I can't wait to get it up and have everybody view it.
I just want to thank everybody who participated in this podcast and sent us feedback. It's appreciated, and hopefully you guys are all going to be on board for season 3 in just a few short months, and we're looking forward to it.
It'll be here before we know it.
This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
And I am your host, Em.
I mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.